This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. A little more than a week ago, the members from two conservative organizations in Utah, the Utah Eagle Forum and Pro-Life Utah, showed up at a meeting of the Utah Board of Education. They were upset about a teacher's guide for health educators, those that teach sex ed. And let me just give a warning at this point and also acknowledge the irony of it. We're talking about sex on the show today, so it may not be a conversation for the young people listening. There is this part in the law that allows a teacher to respond to what are, according to the guidelines, spontaneous student questions to clear up inaccurate or misleading information. Now, that's the part of the guideline that bothers these groups. And here are some of the questions they found graphic and inappropriate. What is oral and anal sex? Can a girl become pregnant without penetration? What is a wet dream? What is an erection? Now, teachers are very restricted in what they can tell students about sex in public schools in Utah. Like other conservative states, this state has a policy of teaching abstinence-only sex ed. And the law is clear that when a teacher is answering a spontaneous question, they still can't just go off. The rules still apply. You can't talk about sexual techniques. You can't talk about the intricacies of stimulation or erotic behaviors. And they are technically not even, they don't even have to answer the question if they're uncomfortable. They can just shut it down. But the Eagle Forum sees these questions and answers as a kind of end run around the law, kind of like a loophole. And today in the program, we're talking about the limits and the boundaries of what we can or should be telling young people about sex. Gail Ruzicka of the Eagle Forum will join us in a moment to explain her problem with these questions and answers in the teaching guide, but we're going to begin with a bigger picture. We were interested in how this particular controversy in Utah compares to sex education in other places and at other times. We talked to the education professor and historian Jonathan Zimmerman. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He's written a history of sex education called Too Hot to Handle, and as the title implies, this subject has pretty much always been a dicey one.
Sex education will always be contested, and it will always be constrained by those contestations. The reason it will be contested is that sex and sexuality refer to our most fundamental ideas of ourselves as human beings. Mm-hmm. And so we will always differ about sex education, and that makes sex education in public schools, underlining that, extremely problematic. When I say problematic, I just mean not just contested, but difficult to establish because it's so hard to get a consensus on a subject that's so divisive.
How much of this has been over time about public health versus the moral qualms about sex? Because I'm trying to decide over the decades how much of this debate about sex education was about, you know, outcomes like teen pregnancy or disease, and how much was just about tamping down sexual behavior of young people.
You know, Doug, I think it's always been both of them, and you can't separate them. Because sex is so tied to our basic notions of ourselves as human beings, all sexual statements and all sexual education has moral components. Whether you call it a health or a scientific matter or not, you can't segment out the moral component. I would say even the statement that sex ed should just be about health and science has a moral component.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting is the different forms of morality that have been embodied in sex ed. So, you know, you mentioned that for some people it was about outcomes.
Yeah.
And indeed, in the United States and the UK, that's really been the driving force for sex ed. It's been an effort to prevent negative outcomes, specifically teen STDs and teen unwanted pregnancies. But in the post-Ellen Key Sweden, especially after the Second World War, they develop a different kind of curriculum with a different goal, which is not to ward off negative outcomes, but to promote positive ones, especially a positive, what was called a healthful view of sexuality. And those are different goals.
Yeah. At what point do governments and public leaders start to talk about trying to control sexual behavior through education?
So in the United States, which was really the pioneer of school-based sex education, it begins in the early 20th century in the so-called progressive era amidst venereal disease outbreaks in large American cities like Chicago and New York. Put simply, middle-class white men were patronizing prostitutes, which has always been a major conduit of sexually transmitted diseases, and then going home and infecting their wives. And this created an enormous panic, and a panic that had racial and racist dimensions. There was a fear that white people were going to decrease their fertility because, of course, STDs do inhibit fertility. If working class or non-white people were doing this, it was a less concern. Yeah. But if white people were doing it, it was what Theodore Roosevelt and Jane Addams called race suicide and a focus of fear and panic.
And by race suicide, it meant that the desirable people wouldn't be propagating the species. It would be the less
exactly.
desirable. And I guess that was exactly. a class and racial thing as well, probably.
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
And it was at the heart of many movements, including the birth control movement. I mean, let's remember it was Margaret Sanger, the foremother of birth control, that said more children from the fit, less from the unfit, that was her goal. And all of those terms had profoundly racialized meanings and dimensions.
The various versions of sex education that you write about are really interesting, and I wanted to ask you about some of these. And let's start with the birds and the bees, literally the birds and the bees, because this was when sex education, as you've put it, assumed the form of plant and animal analogies. We didn't want to talk about the humans. We wanted to talk about other creatures, I guess.
That's exactly right. See, what we're trying to do is to teach people to avoid sex without describing sex. There was a fear that if we were too descriptive— at least in human descriptions, that we might, in a forbidden fruit sort of way, enhance kids' interest in the subject. And sex education and drug and alcohol education are like this also. Sex education doesn't fit well in the kind of progressive education paradigm of learning by doing. Mm-hmm. Figures like John Dewey said that the way to teach anything is to engage people in activity. Well, you know what? Sex education in this country has been learning by not doing. You want to teach people not to do something. So the best way to do that, sex educators thought, was to use the plant and animal metaphors that would give them the idea without making the idea too attractive.
I wanted to contrast how the Americans dealt with sex education and how others dealt with it, like in Scandinavian countries, because the differences there are interesting. Now, there are similarities in a lot of places in Western Europe. It's not a distinction necessarily, but it seems like Sweden in particular has, I don't know if it's right to say a more permissive or progressive attitude, but they seemed to see educating young people about sex in certainly different ways than the American.
Definitely. And you know, I should confess to you, Doug, that I come by this subject honestly because my mother was a sex educator. The book you're referring to is dedicated to her. I suppose in a very Freudian way, one of the reasons I wrote the book was to take issue with some of the things my mom taught me. One of the things she taught me was that Sweden was ahead of the United States, or the Scandinavian countries. They were very progressive, much more so than the United States. Well, the image of ahead or behind, I think, is a problem because any race metaphor, and now I'm talking about a foot race, implies the same starting and finish gate,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
It implies the same target. And what I found as I investigated this subject is actually, in Scandinavia especially, they had a very different goal. And the goal was to help each child recognize and develop and enjoy their sexuality.
Can we say that there can we make any conclusions about outcomes? For example, if the Swedes say that their goal is to allow young people to, as you put it in the book, discover and develop their own sexual selves, if that's the goal, does that go hand in hand with the health outcomes? That is, not only are they discovering their own sexual selves, but they're less inclined to get pregnant before they want to or have sexually transmitted disease.
Well, I would say maybe and we don't know.
Yeah.
And in fact, that was part of this guy's response. The other thing he says in his response is he says, it's true that those rates are lower, the rates you're referring to, teen pregnancy and STDs, in our country than yours, but we don't know that that's because of sex ed.
Right.
And you know what, Doug, that's true what he said. We don't know that. And this is why in any country, if you turn on the radio to your station or any other, and you hear somebody opining on sex ed and they are speaking with absolute certainty about its, quote, outcomes, if on the right they're saying that it makes the kids have more sex, or on the left that it makes the kids, you know, wear condoms or act more responsibly, if they're speaking with full certainty, you should write them off as an ideologue and a charlatan. There isn't enough sex ed to know that. I mean, in a country like the United States, where some kids get a total of 6 or 12 hours of sex ed in schools a year, how, as a matter of social science, could you ever isolate that as the relevant variable in a behavior that's so messy and inchoate and weird as sexual behavior, right? Yeah. How would you know if it was those 6 or 12 hours that were the influencing factor?
Yeah. Here in Utah, there's a conservative organization often at the heart of these disputes. It's the Eagle Forum. And the reason we're talking to you is because they've raised alarm about the kinds of questions that young people are apparently able to legally ask of their sex education teachers, you know, that they're just – they're worried that it's just too explicit. When does this begin historically? Because you mention – how there was this shift in the 60s and 70s where conservative groups start protesting this kind of education? Or has there always been this kind of moral alarm?
There's absolutely always been this moral alarm. In fact, going back to the plant and animal metaphors, in some ways they were a response to that moral alarm,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
A response to the alarm that, oh my God, we're talking about human beings having sex in our schools. So there's always been that fear, but it absolutely steps up in the 60s and 70s because of broader changes in the culture, right? Mm. You know, because there's more explicit sex and sexuality on television and films. There's the rise of the porn industry. There's explicit sexual imagery in music. So it makes sense that during those decades, I think there would be more concern about that subject, and especially about the way that those images or sounds or ideas are influencing and affecting young people.
Mm. So if you look at the debate over sex education throughout the years and throughout the world, this is more than just ideology. It's more than just conservatives versus progressives. There's also a cultural dimension. There's also a religious dimension, and it also seems like it's a question of where this conversation should be had, the primacy of the home, whether these conversations should be in private, whether states should be invested in these kinds of things. I guess that's what makes it so complicated. Is this is all over the map?
Without a doubt, and I should add that the question of family and parent rights versus school rights, in some ways, changes in the United States and in other countries after the HIV/AIDS crisis. You know, AIDS changed everything in the United States and the world, and it changed sex ed, and here's how. Before AIDS, the debate often unfolded along the axes that you just described. So people who favored sex ed, well, they wanted schools to address the subject, and people that were against it said, oh, no, this is a family or a religious matter, and the school should have nothing to do with it. After the HIV/AIDS crisis, almost nobody said that.
Yeah.
And the people on the right who formerly had said that schools should have no business addressing the subject, they actually developed their own sex ed curriculum, which in the United States is called abstinence only.
Right.
And I think you really need history to appreciate what a concession abstinence only education is on the part of the American right.
Hmm.
Because it's brought to you by conservatives who, pre-HIV crisis, didn't think the school should have anything to do with the subject. But after HIV, almost nobody can maintain that. And the same goes for countries around the world, especially in Africa, which, of course, was and remains the heart of the HIV crisis. Those countries had nothing to do with sex in their schools until HIV, and now all of them teach about it.
One of the things you've said is that mass media has had a much more profound effect on children's sexuality in the 20th century than, as you say, any set of formal educational institutions. And I want to ask you about that because this, again, there was some sense from, I think it was a Swedish educator or educational leader who talked about that a school is not a spearhead, but it's a mirror, that it needs to deal with the way sex is being portrayed in the culture in general, the broader culture, I guess.
That's correct. And, you know, look, I think we should all be sanguine about what schools can accomplish in this zone. And now I'm talking about public schools. Private,
right.
It's very different,
sure.
Right, because it's self-selected. And a private school, if a parent doesn't like the sex ed in a private school, the private school is completely within its rights to say, well, you know, maybe you should think about another school. right? A public school can't do that. A public school can't say, you're not into our sex ed, why don't you like sell your house, right, and move to another place. But we should all be sanguine about what schools can accomplish in this zone. But we should also realize that schools are not the lone educator. My research has been about public schools as sex educators, but my book is actually quite short. And the reason is public schools don't do a lot of sex educating.
Yeah.
Doug, everyone gets a sex education. All 7 billion people get a sex education. They get it from the moment they're born. But they get it mainly from places that aren't school. The first place they get it, of course, is from their families. But then, especially with the development of electronic entertainment and communication, they get it from mass media. Mm. And if you interview kids about where they get their sexual information, and we've been doing this in America for 100 years, family, peers, and media, and those are the three, and they rotate amongst themselves. But like school, it's down at like 5%. You know, 5% of kids identify that as the place they get it. And I should tell you that I'm not against school-based education, absolutely not, but I think we should be realistic about what it can accomplish for the reasons I'm describing. But we should also, I think, be much more aware and much more supportive, frankly, of the possibilities that mass media presents for sex education.
Yeah.
So pornography is a form of sex education. I would say in most cases it's a very poor form of sex education. And in some ways a dangerous one. But there are other forms that are much more salutary. So some state health agencies and also private organizations like Planned Parenthood, they run these text messaging services where, you know, your friend tells you you can't get pregnant the first time or you can't get pregnant when you have your period. And instead of listening to your friend or to somebody else who's equally uninformed, you text that agency and somebody texts you back with real information. What I just described is sex education.
Yeah.
It's absolutely sex education. But I would argue it's much more promising than many of the forms we've been describing for a number of reasons. The first is it meets the kids where they are. And the kids are on their screens.
Yeah.
You may find reasons to bemoan that. I have. But you certainly can't deny it. The kids are on screens way more than they're in school. So it meets the kids where they are, i.e. on their screens. And it's also individuated. Right? It's personal. You don't need a collective consensus about it because you're not transmitting it to a million different people. It's just for this kid. And it may well be that those kinds of sex education are really where we should be putting our energies and our attention.
You mention in your book how the reason there's always been controversy about this subject is because, and this is how you put it, there's always been this unease and disagreement about childhood sexuality. And I'm wondering if you think that's ever going to change. You talk about how schools have never been able to bring sex fully into their orbit, how sex education has always exceeded its grasp. Do you foresee a time when we'll ever settle this question about childhood sexuality, or does that seem like this persistent taboo?
It will persist, Doug.
Yeah.
It will never end. And indeed, it may get even more contentious as this thing called globalization becomes even more accelerated. You know, why is there so little sex ed? Because of globalization. If by globalization you mean the very rapid movement of people and ideas across borders, what it means is the places we inhabit are becoming irreducibly diverse. And what that means is you have ever more people from ever different camps, if you will, different points of view, and they do not agree about the nature of sexuality. And they never will.
Yeah. And if we can't agree on the parameters of the conversation, of the debate, if we can't agree on the goals, we can never measure the outcomes properly. We're always going to be debating this, it seems.
Yes. And you know, I would say, though, it depends, Doug, on what you mean by outcomes.
Hmm.
You know, it's important to realize that in some ways, even though we have so little sex ed, we put an even greater burden on it in terms of the expected outcomes than in any other part of the curriculum. The math teacher is not expected to influence what the kids do on Friday or Saturday night. The math teacher is expected to help the kids understand algebra.
Yeah.
You know, when we frame these behavioral outcomes for sex ed, in some ways we're asking more of it than we do of any other part of the curriculum. So I don't think those outcomes are particularly realistic. I think they're especially difficult to measure. But I think there are other ways of thinking about outcomes that are more analogous to the algebra teacher, which is, did you learn about the subject? And I should tell you that we do have some very solid research suggesting that good sex ed does influence people's understanding and knowledge, which isn't surprising. Right? I think good sex ed happens in history class, it happens in English class and science class, because all those subjects involve sex or address sex. The problem is the I would say, naive faith that enhanced knowledge and understanding is going to alter behavior. I think that's where we get into a lot of, I think, very, very facile assumptions about the way that people act, which does not always corroborate with what they know.
Seems like that's the only way we can conceive of sexual outcomes is by interpreting behavior.
Exactly. But I think that we should rethink that. Sexuality is a part of the human experience. It's a part of human history. It's a part of religion. It's part of culture and society. We can't avoid it, and we shouldn't. But I would encourage all of us to try to get to a place where we agree that we have to discuss the subject, but we don't agree that we have to agree on it.
That's Jonathan Zimmerman. His book is Too Hot to Handle, A Global History of Sex Education. When we come back from a break, Gail Ruzicka of the Eagle Forum will be with us. This is Radio West.
Support for KUER comes from the local and national businesses around the state that underwrite our programming. Shows like Morning Edition, Radio West, and All Things Considered. If your business or organization cares about the in-depth local news and fascinating conversations you can only find on public radio, team up with KUER. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
At a recent Board of Education meeting, the members of some of Utah's conservative organizations, the Eagle Forum was one, took issue with the questions and answers in a teacher's guide. The guide is supposed to help educators respond to some pretty tough questions that they often get from kids about sex. But Gail Ruzicka says these questions and the answers go way too far. Gail Ruzicka is joining us here in the studio. She's president of the Utah Eagle Forum. They identify themselves as a pro-family, pro-life group. And welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here, Doug.
What's the goal of sex education? What should be the goal?
Well, you know, the goal is to help children and answer questions. There's no doubt about it. But first of all, the main goal should be to try to encourage parents to do that job, so that the children are in an individual situation where they're sitting down with their parents one-on-one, asking their questions, parents are answering it, and at the same time the parents are answering, they answer those value questions, those things that will help children to make healthy decisions.
You can't connect the value part from this conversation, is your opinion. It's absolutely tied to morality and values. Is that
well,
right?
And I think they can. I mean, in fact, that's what they should be doing. They should be talking to the children about the heart, about morality, about the advantages of keeping themselves morally clean and pure, and mainly the advantages of not having sex when they're teenagers. That's not healthy. It's not the right way to go, and it doesn't have good outcomes. And so everything we do should be directed towards encouraging them to make healthy choices and outcomes that will improve their life situation, and teaching them, you know, it's something that they wait to do.
When you talk about outcomes, or when we talk about goals, one of the things that we were talking about earlier on the program was the idea that part of the goal is often teen pregnancy rates and STD figures. Like, these are outcomes that you can sort of measure. But another goal, at least according to Zimmerman, that should be included there is that young people have a healthy sense of their sexuality, that under the proper circumstances, sex is about love and bonding as well as reproduction, and they should have a healthy sense of sexuality. Does that make you uncomfortable?
Well, it doesn't make me uncomfortable at all. That's exactly what it should be. And that's why I was so concerned about these questions, because these questions don't lead in that direction. conversations in the classroom, if they're based on, and we don't have abstinence only in this state for the most part. We have abstinence based or plus, as some people, the same thing. There are four districts that do abstinence only, but the rest of the state does this abstinence plus, which means they can teach about contraception and things, but they are not to teach the things that are in these questions. And that was the discussion, because, you know, almost 90% of the parents in the state of Utah sign to allow their children to take sex education. We are a state that has opt-in, and no child can take sex education classes without first their parents signing. And the parents, the information the parents are given when they make that decision does not include these questions. They would have no idea that they're going to be discussing these subjects in the classroom. And when a child asks that question, the whole classroom gets the answer. Not that it should be one-on-one. If questions should be answered, but not to a classroom of young people who didn't ask the question. And only the person who asked the question should get the answer.
I don't want to make you uncomfortable. I know that you didn't want to ask any of these questions at the actual board meeting itself. So I'm not sure how far I can go here.
Well, as long as I don't have to say it, you can say whatever you want.
Okay. Here's one of the questions. In this guide, can you lose your virginity by using a tampon? And here's the answer as it's laid out. People define virginity in different ways, but most define a virgin as one who's never had sexual intercourse. Using this definition, you cannot lose your virginity by using a tampon. Now, what's wrong with that?
That's not one of the questions I'm concerned about.
It isn't.
No, you know, I'm not concerned about every question. But there are multiple questions go beyond the law.
Okay, one of the ones that I understand you object to, what is oral and anal sex? You don't think that's appropriate?
I do not think that's appropriate, and I'm sure the parents don't either, because then they go on to answer it, and it's a graphic answer. It tells. In fact, it's so interesting when when they tell the teachers you can't answer questions of technique. And there are three questions that in that list of 29 questions there. Three of them, they say, oh, I can't answer that.
Yeah.
It's technique. One of them is, how do you put on a condom?
Right.
It says, you know, well, look up the, you know,
I can't answer that question.
I can't answer that question. Yeah. So you need to look at the instructions in the package. And yet they can answer a question that, you know, that tells them detail about how to have sex, and it's about sexual practices. And there's another question there where it says, you know, I think the question was, how do you, what is sexual relations?
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher.
Yeah, what is sex?
Yeah. And the teacher answers that question by saying it's more than just sexual intercourse. And then they go on to say the very things that you were talking about. And so that child in that class is taught right there that, in a way that most parents don't teach their children. When parents sit down and teach their children, they don't say, now there's all different kinds of sex and they're all acceptable. And so when you're having sexual relations, you might be having, here's sexual intercourse and that's how that is. But let's talk about some of the other ways that you can have sex. That's not how most parents talk.
Because they're talking to one person.
Yeah.
And they have their own values, their own
sense of
morality.
That's right. And that's the way it should be. Mm. So one of the things I said, and I have been talking to the superintendent back and forth about this, is that if they're going to allow for these spontaneous questions, and the ones that are listed here are not all of them, it's just the ones that are most frequently asked. There's a lot more, and I've talked to health teachers, and they've told me some of the other questions that they are asked. But if they're going to do that, then the parents should get a copy of what I have in front of me, what you have in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
They should say, here's the questions that are most frequently asked. We have them right here. They're online. Here's a copy for you to read, because you need to know that more than likely your child is going to hear some of these questions in the classroom as the questions are asked. That would change a lot of parents' decision about signing to let their children be in this classroom. So, you know, we have this high percentage, almost 90% sign their children in for sex education. That's huge. And so that says, okay, the parents here are supportive, but they're supportive of the law. And these questions go way beyond the law. So let the parents see the questions if you're going to continue and allow these kinds of questions. Or the other solution is to stick with the curriculum that the parents have signed into. And when a child has a question,
take them aside.
Well, either take them aside or send them to the school nurse or the school counselor and let them sit down. These questions should be individual. These are not classroom questions. And one girl told me that she felt like it was sexual harassment in her mind. And the reason she felt that way is that she was embarrassed. She didn't want to be there. Hmm. She had her head down. And it's boys and girls in the same class. this is something she never wanted to hear, and now she's having to stay there and hear it. And in her mind, all the boys were looking at her because they were talking about her body parts.
Yeah. Here's something you told us. You said that when you're teaching kids that sex is normal and natural, you increase the amount of sex they have. What do you mean by that?
No, not that you teach. No, that's not what I said. I said when you teach these sexual practices
as being that, normal and natural.
And in some families, they're not. I mean, for some people, they are. But when you teach these, just like that question.
But what do you mean you don't want people to normalize sex?
Normalize sex practices. That's not what I said.
Okay.
I said this, certain sexual practices for a lot of families are not something that they want to talk to their children about, or even something in their family that they don't think is right. And they had that right to that feeling and that belief, and they shouldn't. Their child shouldn't be in a classroom where they're being taught something different than that, and the parents don't even know. And that's the other problem that I brought up about this, you know, is that they have that ROPES program, you know. Each thing stands, it's an acronym that stands for something. And you get down to the S, and this is what the teacher starts out with at the beginning of the year before they start into sex education. They go through the ROPES program, and S stands for said here, stays here. So, and it's a contract. It's an actual contract, an agreement that they sign. Or that they talk about, and that they say this is the agreement if you look at the contract and what it says in the agreement at the top. So they're agreeing as a classroom to each other and to the teacher and that they will not leave that classroom and talk about what was said in that classroom. If it's said here, it stays here. That should never happen in a public classroom. Children should be encouraged to go home. In fact, when they ask these spontaneous questions...
You think that's encouraging students to keep these kinds of things from their parents and others?
Well, from anybody. You know, I mean, but they shouldn't ever. They should say, go home and talk to your parents about what we talked about today. When the child asks the questions, the first thing they should say, you know, that is a question that you really should discuss with your parents. And then that's when they can say, but if that isn't what you want to do, if they have signed parental permission, they can say, but you can go talk to the school nurse and the counselor, but we don't answer those questions in this classroom. Then these children that don't want to hear those answers are protected, that don't want to hear the questions, they don't want to hear the answers, and the girls and boys together, people don't stop and think about, you know, you got the 14-year-old boys and girls in the same classroom. They don't want to talk about these things.
What do you say to the argument, and I'm sure you hear it all the time, that ideally that sounds great, that these kids are going to go home and talk to their parents and that they're going to have healthy conversations with their folks about sex. But that's not reality. That doesn't happen. Some parents are not so good at this. They don't talk about it. So they're left then to look online at times for answers that they might have to questions. What do you say to that? The reality of it as opposed to the ideal sort of situation.
First of all, lots and lots of parents do have that discussion with their children. Lots of parents do.
Yeah. But you do acknowledge that it's not happening in some homes.
There's some that don't.
Yeah.
And they have these sex education classes. They don't need these graphic questions in those classes. These children, the parents didn't sign on for it. The children didn't sign on for it. Children are in the state of Utah, 90% of them are getting sex education classes. And they're abstinence-based. So that means they talk about contraception and other things. So they're getting it in the classroom. Maybe that's even going to help them go home and talk to their parents. But this goes beyond what the parents have agreed to. The parents need to know. And they need to immediately stop this thing of telling children what's said here stays here. That is wrong. How will they ever go home and have a conversation with their parents if they've been told not to? And so even when something comes up, the child then has to decide, okay. I mean, if my children were taking that class, the first thing I'd say to them when they walked in the door, when I would know they were in that 12-week time, tell me about your class today. What did you learn? Let's talk about it. And what's the child supposed to say? They just made an agreement not to do that.
Do you actually think that's the intent of that? That they're trying to keep information from parents?
You know,
I mean,
that
seems like a bit of a stretch.
I don't know what the intent is, but it's there. And it's in this, you know, it's in this document. It's in this very document about questions, and it's in the instructions of what the teachers say. And so how would you interpret that? If you were a child in this class and they said what is said here stays here, how are they supposed to interpret that? And it's called an agreement.
Let me shift gears a bit. I wanted to get a specific question to you on the idea of contraception. If you tell young people about contraception, not show them how it's used or tell them where to buy it, but just inform them about the fact that there's such a thing as contraception, does that cross a line?
It is based on the context. If you're talking about these kinds of questions that's in here, and you start then adding contraception to that, for instance, I mean, or let's say just say disease preventing. One of the questions in there is, you know, what is a dental dam? And they explain that to them.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to contraception, instead they said that's a technique, which, you know, I thought, well, wait a minute, they can talk about contraception.
But should contraception at all come up from your point of view in a sex education class in the state of Utah?
I prefer abstinence only, where there isn't contraception, because you know, if you're going to talk to them about abstinence being the way to prevent a disease, to prevent pregnancy, talk to them about it, and talk to them about the heart and the importance of not having sexual relationships, because this is tough on kids. And those children that are having sex get their heart broken all the time. That leads to depression and suicide and all kinds of things. And if you can help them get through that by not saying, you know, okay, this is, you know, one sentence that, that abstinence best. However, and then teaching contraception goes on a lot longer than saying abstinence is best.
So, what are you going to do about all of this? You've registered your concerns with the Board of Education. Are you going to go to lawmakers to have them further tighten up the guidelines? What's the next step?
Yes, we're talking to legislators right now. We're talking to school board members. We're talking to the superintendent. I haven't talked to any school board members or any legislators. Now, true, I haven't talked to all of them, but the ones that I've talked to that think these questions are appropriate in the classroom, they didn't know about
them. These questions have been around a long time.
Yeah, and nobody's known that they.
When did you discover them?
Well, I knew about spontaneous questions. That's in the law.
The particulars.
Oh, I just discovered them. You know, that's why we were dealing with this. Yeah. It was maybe three, four weeks ago when I was looking on the website. I was going to give a presentation, and some people had asked me some questions. And I thought, well, I better look up and see what the up-to-date things are. You know, things get old. And all of a sudden, there's those questions. And so it was at that point that I began to talk to people, got my friends together and said, hey, we need to make this public. I immediately sent things to the superintendent and the school board members and off to some legislators.
And, are you getting a response? Do you think people will remove these questions?
I've gotten a lot of response, and that's the conversations is about, okay, they don't want to, they want the children to be able to ask their questions. Nobody thinks a child shouldn't be able to ask questions. It's under the, you know, where and when. Classroom's not the place. No child should have to hear those answers or those questions if they don't want to. And so we want to be fair to all children. The ones that want to ask the questions, go talk to the school nurse. The ones that don't want to and don't want to hear them, you don't have to. We'll abide by the law, the one that your parents signed to have you in this classroom. And we won't take you beyond that and put you in that embarrassing situation.
It's Gail Ruzicka, president of the Utah Eagle Forum. Joined us here in the studio. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
KUER's mobile app gives you everything you love about our station on the go. Stream KUER live on your phone. Listen to NPR and local stories on demand. Then shift gears and listen to our 24/7 classical music station or explore podcasts like Radio West and 45 Days. It's all on the KUER app. Download it for free for Android or iOS, wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the limits and just the general diciness of what you can and should teach young people about sex. Joining us now on the program is Kristen Hodson. She's a certified sex therapist, also the founder and executive director of The Healing Group. That's a clinic specializing in maternal, sexual, and reproductive health. She's with us here in the studio, and welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm guessing, is your mind racing after listening to Gail Ruzicka and Jonathan Zimmerman? Do you have a lot of things on your mind right
now? Yeah. I mean, but that tends to be the climate within Utah when we're discussing this.
How are you thinking? Like, just give me a knee-jerk reaction. We'll get into particulars here as we go to what you were hearing from Gail. I mean, on one hand, I'm guessing there are a lot of parents who are saying, maybe it's not exactly the right place in a sex ed class to talk about a wet dream. Maybe that's not right. Maybe that should be playing out at home. That seems entirely reasonable to me. What do you think?
Well, so to Jonathan's point, I too took to Instagram to meet people where they were to get this information. And I'm mostly focusing on parents. And many parents don't even know these terms that a lot of the kids are trying to ask or understand. And a lot of them will say, oh, will you Google that for me? Because I don't want to. But I will tell you that their kids will Google it for them because they're comfortable with Google. They know that they'll get an answer and it can be quick. Or they'll discuss it with peers. But what's interesting is a lot of peers, these conversations are happening more often in hallways than in a classroom. That you could, with these spontaneous questions, it might allow a teacher to do kind of bystander intervention where they overhear a conversation and say, hey, that's not appropriate. I'll talk. Let's get you that's an important question. Let's get you to that right information. But these ideas that these questions are just spontaneously happening all the time in classrooms seems to be the teachers I've talked to is not happening.
So the teachers So they're not asking these spontaneous questions. And so I'm guessing how teachers are responding, because it seems like in some ways, oh gosh, these questions are pretty explicit. There's some explicit answers there. It seems like guidelines are giving them maybe some leeway, but you're saying they're not really even getting the questions at all?
Well, I think they can. I don't want to say they're not at all. But you will hear from the English teacher that they'll say, I'm not trained in this. I'm probably not the best person to be having this conversation. But these questions are important. And so I think what you've seen is we are a culture lacking in sexual health education. The teachers grew up in an abstinence-based culture. Mm-hmm. The parents grew up in an abstinence-based culture. And what Utah has done is the line has been so blurry that teachers have tended to stay really far away from that line. And now defining it and understanding these questions have allowed teachers to get a little bit closer to intervene or talk, because these conversations, also while we'd ideally like them to happen at home, they're happening where kids are among peers trying to figure this out together.
Yeah. I wonder, we were talking with Jonathan Zimmerman earlier about how the difference between goals often in different places. Mm-hmm. Like on one hand, you look and say, oh, the teen pregnancy rates are low. We must be doing a good job about talking to kids about sex. But in other places, he mentioned Sweden as one, they're about healthy sexuality. Mm-hmm. What do you make about how far away is, and I won't even say just Utah, I'll say the United States in general, which tends to be a little puritanical in its mm-hmm. the way they talk about sex sort of in public education circles. How far away are we from this idea of even granting young people a sense of healthy sexuality?
Well, let me put some numbers out, because in the United States, kids are on average getting 17.2 hours of sexual health information. We could use the term literacy. Contrast that with math and English, and they will specifically say you need to start introducing letters or numbers in a basic format so you can build on them and grow and increase context and competency. 17.2 hours is about a year, or I'm sorry, 1 hour a year. They're not going to be literate. Yeah. They're not going to understand what's going on. They're not going to understand the nuance, the interaction of emotion and pressure and navigating. Like, we can give them facts, but they also are up against large social pressures, knowing what to do when they're in a high pressure situation. And so I would say we're very far and from that mark of promoting sexual health, because we're not even giving them a chance to build on this information. Go down to Utah County, where just 3 days ago we learned that chlamydia is more common than the flu. And those are where it's reported. You can see symptoms with the flu. You often can't see symptoms with chlamydia. So that's a public health number that we can measure and say, well, that's a problem. And that's somehow due to a lack of information. Where that information should be coming, that could be up for debate, but that's a big gap in information.
Gary Edwards, who's the director of the Salt Lake County Health Department, called the rise in STD rates alarming. Chlamydia in Salt Lake County up 40% over the last 5 years, I think is the right number. Gonorrhea up 800%.
They keep growing, and a lot of these are invisible, and a lot of kids don't understand how they're transmitted. And then that the the long-term consequence really can be infertility. There's a lot of symptoms that can show up down the road or consequences. But in my work, I see a lot of creative workarounds or ideas that if it's not intercourse per se, then you're not at risk for anything. And so there could be an argument that kids are actually engaging in riskier behaviors because they don't have the information to prevent, protect, and to make an informed decision.
I probably should have raised these numbers, these STD rates with Gail Ruzicka, because I think what she would probably point out is that teen pregnancy rates, abortion rates in Utah are lower.
Sure.
Now, is that just a function of the fact that there's a predominant faith that that prohibits premarital sex? I mean, what do you make of that?
It could, but then again, we're still looking at sex as merely a behavior.
Yeah.
There's so much more to it than just a behavior to reproduce. And so that's good news. There is some positive outcome that we're having a reduction in unplanned pregnancies. But if we were to look at all these other interactions that are happening, go down to BYU, and we were having big problems with sexual assault. We're having big problems around consent. We're having a lot of other surrounding issues that are highly problematic. But if we're just distilling it down into sex as a behavior, we're really missing a lot of the conversation.
So I wonder about the idea of consent. When you talk to kids about consent, and this came up in the way they were changing the state's sex ed curriculum, mm-hmm. this idea of when you talk about just saying consent is teaching. There's this sense that was teaching young people to be permissive.
Right.
What did you make of that? How that may illustrate the way we do or don't educate young people about sex?
Well, it was disappointing because last year we actually had a bill that was up to teach consent skills.
Yeah.
And then the Eagle Forum got involved and unfortunately it got moved to refusal skills. Well, if we look at consent down in the most basic form, kids are having to learn how to share toys. That's a developmentally appropriate way to teach consent. And then you can build on that. And what's disappointing is when you move just to refusal skills, you're furthering rape culture and this idea that the onus is on the refuser. Did they refuse well enough? Was their message clear enough? Was it understood? What were they wearing? Like, you can really question the refuser. And consent skills can also umbrella refusal skills. But refusal skills doesn't really umbrella consent skills. And putting responsibility on both parties of how to negotiate the situations or the behaviors that they're going to engage in, how to respect a no, what to do with a yes, and how to navigate that.
I wanted to get back to what you were talking about, how it's often we focus on behavior rather mm-hmm. than almost anything else. What does a healthy sex education program look like that isn't focused on behavior? And it seems like this might be an area where you and Gail Ruzicka would agree. I mean, what she said earlier on the program was, yes, I want young people to have a healthy sense of sexuality. Mm-hmm. Now, her definition of what that means might be different from yours.
Sure.
And you are not going to agree on the particulars of what kinds of questions and answers could be or should be asked in school. But what does it look like to teach kids about healthy sexuality that doesn't include some of these specific questions, or can you even tease those apart?
Absolutely. I mean, Jonathan talked about a lot about media. Teaching media literacy is really a crucial part of the conversation around sexual health, communication, emotions, developing personal values. Those are all things that have everything to do with sexual health, but we don't think about it because they're not a behavior. But that's where relationships begin. That's where kids are engaging at the earliest ages and stages of relationships. They're not engaging in behavior. They're learning how to relate to another human being in a respectable way. And so that's really where it can begin. You don't have to start with all these other places. And in fact, it's not appropriate. However, if you haven't been giving them these building blocks, and then by the time they get to high school, and in Utah only get 6 hours of sexual health education, they also don't have the context to know where to then put this additional information they're getting.
So I wonder what you think about, it's interesting to hear Gail Ruzicka talk about with kind of this deep sense of suspicion that the Board of Education has hidden these questions and answers. They've been around for a long time, mm-hmm. but the implication was that they're hiding it. Not only that, according to this ropes contract that she brought up. They are, in fact, encouraging young people to keep this stuff from their parents. I don't know, I won't have you speak for the education department or anything like that, but what do you make of that contention?
And I heard that differently. I heard that to be to respect another's privacy and the confidentiality of another student, to not engage in slander, bullying outside of this classroom. That is along the lines of boundaries and consent, an appropriate principle or principles of sexual health. That is not to say Utah, when you really look into this, is really trying to create a partnership between the school and parents. And Gail and I can agree there. We would love to see this both in the home. And a lot of parents aren't doing it. So we need to come up with another plan that really does emulate Utah values, but that bridges these large gaps in how kids are getting educated.
Less than a minute, so let's get to this really quickly. What do you think is going to happen now? There's been this uproar from these two organizations. Gail's looking for lawmakers to sort of restrict it further. What do you think is going to happen?
Well, I will say this. Unless the people that are listening to this show, they might hear it. They might experience a range of emotions. And if they don't get involved, then more legislation will be pushed because there are plenty of organizations that will be active and vocal. And so people need to find how they can get involved now, because this is where it begins for the legislative session in February.
Kristen Hodson, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
She's a certified sex therapist, founder and executive director of A Healing Group, a local health clinic. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can go to our website and, subscribe to our free podcast. It's at radiowest.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.